This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. In 1939, the American reporter Dorothy Thompson asserted that, like the play was to the Renaissance and the novel in the 19th century, journalism was her era's most representative form of letters. She made that claim in an era when American foreign correspondents were household names. People like John Gunther and Jimmy Sheehan, H.R. Knickerbocker, and Thompson herself were important figures in chronicling the turmoil in Europe in the years after the Great War. And they helped Americans understand why that war would eventually have to be rechristened the First World War. My guest today, Deborah Cohen, tells the story of those writers in her new book, Last Call at the Hotel Imperial, The Reporters Who Took on a World at War. Cohen is the Richard W. Leopold Professor of History at Northwestern University, where she's also chair of the History Department. Deborah Cohen, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. I love your show, so it's really a pleasure to be here with you.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. So let's begin, as you do in your book, with the cast of characters. And I really want to start by focusing on two who had strong ties to Illinois. So first off, who was John Gunther?
John Gunther was a Chicagoan who was a cub reporter for the Chicago Daily News, a graduate of the University of Chicago. And he really made his name in 1936 with a book called Inside Europe that was a behind-the-scenes account of the dictators rising on the European continent. And that book reflected 12 years of on-the-spot, on-the-ground reporting for the Chicago Daily News across Europe.
Yeah, I encountered him. Oh, go ahead. Sorry, please.
Oh, no. You.
I say I encountered him a few years ago through a reprint edition I stumbled across in a used bookstore of his Inside USA, because he had this whole series of Inside X books at the time. But you write, I mean, it's difficult now, I think, for modern audiences to understand, because he's not a household name today, but he was the biggest writer in English, at least at that time, right? Or one of the two.
Absolutely. I guess. Yeah. So John Gunther had more bestsellers in the U.S. market between the mid-30s and the mid-50s than any writer other than the romance novelist Daphne du Maurier. I mean, he was an immensely important reporter, not just for bringing news of the world abroad back to America, but as you say, for his book Inside USA, published in 1947, that was a sort of portrait of America for itself. Those books sold in the millions. It used to be that any garage sale you went to, any used bookstore, they were there in abundance.
So let's also talk about Vincent Sheehan, who was born in Downstate, Illinois.
Exactly. Vincent Sheehan, otherwise known as Jimmy Sheehan, grew up in the town of Pena, Illinois. Like Gunther, he also went to the University of Chicago. He sort of rockets out of Pena and becomes an on-the-spot reporter, foreign correspondent for the Chicago Tribune first, and then for a host of other papers. He is everywhere where anything is happening in the 20s and in the 30s. So he's there when the annexation, the Anschluss of Austria happens. He's there at the Munich crisis. He is everywhere. He writes, like Gunther, he has a really big book, really era-defining book entitled Personal History, which is published in 1935. And it's the story through his work as a foreign correspondent of one young American man's attempt to find his place in the world. But Jimmy Sheehan goes from being born in Pena to a decade later, he's writing memoirs for post-European royalty. He's consorting with the Bloomsbury Group. He is a very good friend of Eddie Sackville-West, who owns the biggest house in Britain, the House Knoll. And he becomes a lover of Eddie Sackville-West, as well as of the post-impressionist English painter Duncan Grant. So in a way, these are stories of going out, of adventuring, of seeing the world, of finding oneself, and trying to understand the relationship between the individual and the world around them.
Yeah, and I want to talk a little more later about the idea of this sort of like adventuring being one of the guiding ethos of their journalism at the time. But I want to stay for a moment on the Chicago you sketch, because I think you do a really nice job of really taking people back to what Chicago must have been like at this time, right? Rooms choked with smoke from the cigars and pipes, this University of Chicago, which is I'll say sort of like a nouveau riche version of Oxford or Cambridge, right? Like they built, they tried to build this Ivy League university.
Not washing off the panes of glass, letting them get dusty so that they accumulated the wisdom of the ages.
And then there's also this literary scene that's so big. So talk about Chicago in that era that formed both Gunther and Jimmy Sheehan.
Right. So this is the era of the Chicago Renaissance. So it's, you know, the Renaissance that we know through Sandburg and through the Black Renaissance as well. And those writers, Gwendolyn Wright, it is a literary awakening that makes Chicago, as H.L. Mencken says, the most exciting city in the world for literature. And that excitement is to a great extent powered by the newspapers. So there's a profusion of newspapers in Chicago, like most American big cities, but these are competitive newspapers all racing to get the news, the latest gangster shootout, the society lady who tosses herself off the top of a building. There's a kind of ragtag, chip on the shoulder, slangy reporting on the gangsters feeling about Chicago journalism. And as I said, it's really Chicago journalism is that's part of the ethos that powers what is happening in the literary renaissance. You know, what we think about as Poetry Magazine and the sort of more decorous literary renaissance. And these reporters are fully in the middle of it. So John Gunther is going between reporting on Rotary Club luncheons and then, you know, staking out gangsters in their hideouts and going to Colosinos and you know, hanging out, trying to get the news.
Yeah.
And they so bring that ethos, that Chicago ethos, when they become foreign correspondents. So as one of them says, they treated European society like a gilded police court, which is such a great phrase for thinking about where that kind of ne'er-do-well Chicago, you know, irreverence, how that meets a European reporting scene.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, and yet, as even though Chicago is this beacon for literature, as you said, Mencken described it, a lot of young Americans, Gunther and Sheehan among them, were drawn to Europe. How common was it for young Americans to decamp for the continent in this era?
Well, in the 20s, it's very common. So what we see are cheap passages on boats. You could also work, as Bill Shire does, growing up in Cedar Rapids, co-college. He then works the cattle boat to get over to Europe. So Chicago, of course, was in some ways a very Europhile city. All you have to think about is those inscriptions on the public library, now the Chicago Cultural Center, with the names of the European greats. And for people like Gunther and Sheehan, who were bookworms as kids, you know, who's learning about the world really came via books, they're exasperated. They're exasperated by what they see as European, American moralism. What they want is the kind of free living that's available in Europe, with condoms available in every drugstore and prostitutes soliciting you on the street, as well as the high culture that they see as properly the province of Europe.
Yeah, America in Prohibition at this time, right?
No less, indeed, yeah, right? America as a place where, you know, hypocrisy seems to reign. You can't get a drink. There are no, later on when they come back and they, you know, see America again in the 1930s, they're astonished by how much it's changed, how sophisticated it's gotten. But the feeling in the 1920s is that this really is the backwater. And if you're going to make yourself, you need to go abroad. And as I said, that's not uncommon for a group of Americans, you know, young people in their 20s. There are tens of thousands of them who are expatriating themselves, going to live in Paris or Berlin or Vienna.
Were these, were your characters well prepared to be foreign correspondents?
No, I mean, in fact, there's, to some extent, so there had been, you know, always a tradition of war reporting, and there had, you know, always been people who were reporters who were over there sending stories back. But what you see in the 20s and 30s, what's known otherwise as the golden age of American foreign correspondents, is the ragtag nature of it. Only in really big cities like London and Paris and Berlin are there proper bureaus. But other than that, they're employing stringers, or your bureau is actually your apartment. John Gunther and Jimmy Sheehan, and the third major sort of figure in my book, H.R. Knickerbocker, who was a Texan, they had actually been cub reporters on big city papers. But the women in the book, Dorothy Thompson, and the woman whom John Gunther marries, Frances Feinman, they had actually worked in PR, not as journalists. And so they very much just get themselves over to Europe with a couple hundred dollars in their handbags and declare themselves to be reporters and start to do the work. And that turns out to be a very successful strategy for someone like Dorothy Thompson.
Yeah, and I think we can talk a little bit more about it later. You still see people trying to follow that model today with some success. All right, let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st Show. We're speaking with Deborah Cohen, who's a professor of history at Northwestern University and the author of the new book, Last Call at the Hotel Imperial, The Reporters Who Took on a World at War, which looks at a group of reporters, both a sort of inner circle and the wider circle of foreign correspondents, mostly in Europe, but around the world in the years leading up to World War II. Let's talk. You mentioned the women in your book, and maybe this is a good time to bring in Frances Feinman Gunther, who, as you say, was as you write, was much probably better prepared than her husband to be a foreign correspondent, right? She'd read works on Marxism. She had a sort of a broader education, and she pushed her husband to think more deeply, right, about the deeper forces at work. And there's this contrast that, you know, this style of just writing down a bunch of detail, right? Getting as much detail, that sort of ground level view, but maybe it doesn't have as much analysis in it. Can you compare and contrast their styles?
Yeah, so the dynamic between Frances Feinman and John Gunther was, you know, is part of what powers the book. So he, as I said, he's got experience as a cub reporter at the Chicago Daily News, but he's not an analytic reporter, at least not at first. That's not his strong suit. And he very much recognizes that. Whereas Frances is Feinman is a very theoretical person. So she's been psychoanalyzed, you know, very much of an a la mode person. She's participated in Marxist reading groups. She's well educated, as are a number of women of her class and generation. So half of the university population, nearly half of the university population in America in the 1920s were women. And so she's always exhorting her husband to think about economics, to think about the structural factors. She is urging him to get psychoanalyzed himself. And the dynamic is very much of what happens is that he is a great and fluid and an easy writer, and she has an epic case of writer's block. So the dynamic evolves, as he says, where she's his brain's trust. She does his quote unquote thinking for him, and he writes it up. And she, on the other hand, you know, has lots and lots of ideas, but she just revises and revises her work endlessly and really doesn't end up publishing very much at all. There's her archives, which are at the Radcliffe Institute at the Schlesinger Library, are just an exercise in self-frustration. So she publishes one book about the Indian freedom struggle, but that's not until the war.
It's an epic case of writer's block, right?
Epic, yes, yes. She calls herself lyrically a Penelope writer, which is that whatever she writes in the morning, she unpicks in the evening. And part of what she's interested in is why it is that she frustrates herself in that fashion. And that becomes an interrogation of really a very, very troubled and troubling youth.
So we need to take a break in a couple of minutes here, but before we do, maybe we can set up, I want to move into talking about, you know, one of the, I think a lot of your book resonates with current debates in journalism about objectivity, but maybe we can set up just by saying what was happening in Europe. Remind our listeners about this, you know, struggle or conflict when it seemed like there were three potential, at least credible forms of governance that people could choose, right? Democracy, fascism, or communism.
That's right. What the 20s and the 30s witness, not just in Europe, but across the world, is really a three-cornered contest between democracy, which people think maybe after the First World War, there's going to be more democracy, not less, right? The world's safe for democracy. Fascism, which is on the rise of the dictators, so Mussolini, Hitler, and then a bunch of tin pot dictators, as well as Stalin in the Soviet Union, and then communism. And communism itself, as a phenomenon that a lot of young Americans in particular are enchanted with. And so the stories that they're reporting, they essentially go out to Europe and then later to Asia, and they find two stories. One of them is the rise of modern dictatorship. And the second story is the rise of anti-colonial nationalism. So the attacks by people like Gandhi and Nehru, on the British Empire. And those become the two stories that really captivate them and are what they're known for.
And I mean, it's those fights that they write back home and that they make them household names, as we were saying earlier. All right, let me if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Deborah Cohen, who's the Richard W. Leopold Professor of History and Chair of the History Department at Northwestern University. We're talking about her new book, which is called Last Call at the Hotel Imperial: The Reporters Who Took on a World at War. It's about this cast of characters, John Gunther among them, Jimmy Sheehan, both from Illinois, as well as others from other parts of the United States that we don't care as much about here on the 21st show. I joke. But we'll talk more about this. If you want to join our conversation, you can do so at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. More to come with Deborah Cohen after a short break. Stay with us. This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Deborah Cohen, author of Last Call at the Hotel Imperial: The Reporters Who Took on a World at War, about a group of American correspondents in mostly in Europe, but around the world in the years leading up to World War II. These were household names at the time. Many of them are not as much discussed today. And in preparing for this conversation, I came across a book review from Time magazine in 1936 that it reads like it could have been written last week. It says, quote, "A purely objective view may not be misleading, but it often leads nowhere." And then citing the widespread popularity of books like Jimmy Sheehan's Personal History and John Gunther's Inside Europe, which are two of the characters in your book, it says, "Those are strong indications that many an individual still regards the cameraman is more important than the camera." And Deborah, there's a lot of resonances in your book with the current debate on objectivity in journalism, right? What some people have called this view from nowhere. How did you think about those resonances when you were working on this subject?
Yes, this is, I think that the objectivity debate in journalism is absolutely evergreen. So the reporters in my book were schooled in the newsrooms of the early 20s in objectivity, which was itself response to the yellow press of Hearst and William Randolph Hearst and his ilk. And then they go to a Europe where dictatorship is on the rise. And the question for them is, how can you convey what you're seeing? Is it going to be sufficient to essentially pass out the information that Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda chief, has given you? Are you going to be able to inform your public, or do you have to do more interpreting? So foreign correspondents had always been given some latitude for interpretation. But the reporters, foreign correspondents in my book increasingly feel that objectivity is actually not going to be helpful to anyone in understanding what is happening or, as Jimmy Sheehan puts it, the truth is much more than a collection of facts. And what he meant by that is that what the reporter had to do was to give you a sense of right and wrong. So it's very much of the debate that we see now. And, you know, no surprise there, I think, which is that authoritarianism produces a conflict fundamentally for reporters, which is, what do you do? Do you repeat what is being said to you by, you know, government officials whom you know are not telling you the truth? Or do you interpret and call out falsehoods? So, you know, that these are complicated questions. So I'll give you an example, which is, John Gunther is in Berlin the month of the Nazi takeover in January, late January 1933. And he sends reports back to the Chicago Daily News almost every day about the atrocities that he sees happening. So the beatings of Jews, people being dragged away to Nazi brown houses, so-called brown houses where they're tortured. And his editors, who are good liberals at the Chicago Daily News, say, please send us more balanced reporting. We can't just report on these kind of bad stories about the Nazis. You know, what's the other side? And at that point, Gunther is just throwing up his hands in the air, saying there is no other side.
Yeah, the train's running on time, right? I mean, that's the example.
Exactly. And it wasn't that people didn't see that, say, Mussolini was able to, you know, through force and through an authoritarian state, you know, create industrialization beyond, you know, what Italians were imagining. Or Stalin, same thing, right? The forced industrialization of the country under the first five-year plan. But increasingly, the reporters who saw these things firsthand came to believe that what they were seeing was the eradication of the individual. What happens to the individual in mass society? And that, in a sense, it was their duty to defend the individual against the attacks from the right, so fascism, and from the left, from communism.
It strikes me that the opposite of objectivity is subjectivity, right? If you want to just take it at the surface level. But there are more forms of interpretive journalism that you write about, and one of them is emotionalism. Can you talk about the role of maybe this is a way to get into another character, Dorothy Thompson, in your book, and the role of emotion in her work? You have this line in there from Alice Roosevelt Longworth that Dorothy is the only woman in history who's had her menopause in public and made it pay, which reportedly she found to be funny.
Yes, brilliant line, right? She thought it was hilarious. Yes, because she had a very good sense of humor and certainly a sense of irony. What's really important in terms of the emotional style of the 1930s, and I think it's not just the reporters, although they take it on too, but it's also the dictators themselves. Like, this is a highly emotional time. And the reporters, part of what they're doing in casting off strict objectivity is participating in the emotionalism of the time, as Dorothy Thompson says, by trying to mobilize an army on behalf of liberty and in behalf of democracy. And that you can't do that just with dry facts. The reporter Masha Gessen has said something similar in talking about the ways in which Zelensky in Ukraine has rallied the political nation, which is the emotional appeals and the sense of caretaking. And what Thompson, who becomes the first woman op-ed columnist, so by the late 1930s, Dorothy Thompson, in her column On the Record, is speaking to an estimated audience of 8 to 10 million readers three times a week. So a huge, huge, important podium on which she is addressing the American public. And a lot of her columns are just unabashedly emotional, by which I mean appeals to the future of civilization, lots of talking about mothers and babies, using the rhetoric of betrayal, of revenge, of evil, of lies. And of course, for us now, this doesn't seem so far distant. I mean, for the people who follow them the reporters who follow them in the 1950s, who go back to a much more buttoned up, objective form of reporting, this reporting looks over the top. But as we've seen, and as you said, with the critiques of both sidesism, there's a lot of emotional reporting. And no wonder, when you watch innocents be bombed out of their houses and see the kind of depredations of the state, that's not a surprising thing to feel.
Yeah, it came a little bit later, but was it Murrow who said there are not two sides to the Holocaust?
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yes. And this is the idea that, in fact, that even needed to be said, brings us back to the moment and to the kind of contest. Yeah, I guess the other thing I would say about emotionalism that I think is important is that the idea behind objectivity was that it was something that would sell papers, which is the New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, that you could go to those papers or the Chicago Daily News and feel that you were getting reliable news without the kind of stench of yellow journalism. But subjectivity, of course, also pays. And so Dorothy Thompson amasses her huge audience because she's channeling the kind of emotions that so many people are feeling now. Or as the New York Times columnist Michelle Goldberg puts it, the marinating in history, the marinating in politics that people feel that they're doing right now.
I like that phrase. Yeah. All right, let's go to the phones. 800-222-9455. Steve is on line 4 from Chicago. Steve, thank you for calling in.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Very interesting, really enjoying the show. Along the lines of Small World, my youngest daughter actually graduates from the Medill School of Journalism this June from Northwestern. So the
timing, congratulations to her.
Yeah. Indeed, well, congratulations.
Timing is perfect. Your guest more or less touched on what I was going to bring up, but anyway, I was just in comparison the situation today in Ukraine and the instantaneousness of the news. Obviously, we turn on our screen or our phones, and Putin doesn't have time to put a spin on it because it's right there in front of your eyes and you're seeing it in real life. Although I'm guessing that the propaganda he's putting forth is more for his own population than for the world's knowledge. But going back to the 30s and 40s, comparing the transport of the news versus today, which, as I said, is basically instantaneous, where they had time to say, go back and, be more objective, or, taking hours or maybe a day instead of, seconds. I was wondering if your guests would, compare and contrast today's news production, especially with the war in Ukraine, versus how it came out during World War II, and the importance of, the writer's opinions, as you touched on.
Sure.
Versus just, the in front of your face news that we see, every day.
Yeah.
And thank you for taking my call.
Yeah,
thanks,
Steve.
There's so many fascinating points there that you're making. And so let me just take two of them. One of them is that this group of reporters were really charged with figuring out what modern dictatorship was. And so a lot of the analysis that we rely upon when we think about, what makes someone a dictator? And a lot of the analysis that meant that when Putin and the RT, the Putin propaganda machine, were saying, well, this is a, the Ukrainians are attacking us, we're just defending our territory, no one was falling for that any longer. And yet, in the 1930s, when Nazi propagandists are describing themselves as being, barraged by the Poles, or when Mussolini is claiming that Ethiopia is endangering Italian national sovereignty, those are arguments that serious people are taking seriously. So I think one of the things that comes from their reporting that we really do have the benefit of, not just from their reporting, but also decades of work on what dictatorship is a really good sense of, as people said at the time, dictators don't die in bed, right? That their rule has to be ended, and it usually ends violently. So that's one part. The second part of your question that I think is really fascinating too is about the technology. So now we're so used to the idea that we're getting the news almost instantaneously, it seems. But in the 1930s, they had their own technological revolutions. And so if we brought back this group of reporters and we had them on the show, they would be talking about the technological transformations that had sped up the news on their end. And there were two of them that were really important. One of them was the ability to call in the news over the telephone, to call in your stories. And what was so important about that was not just that it was relatively cheap and instantaneous, but it meant that you could also evade censorship. So if the political powers in a country didn't want that news to get through, what they had to do was turn off all of the telephone lines through the entire country, which was obviously a really extreme measure. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing was radio, which was the ability to broadcast. So Dorothy Thompson, when the Nazi tanks roll over the Polish borders, she's on the air for hours and hours and hours, almost a day and a half, reporting directly. So she's not there, but she's receiving and interpreting the news.
Yeah, and Murrow is not a big character in your book, but Bill Shearer is in the sort of bigger circle and broadcast. Some of your subjects deal better with the rise of broadcast news than others. It's just another fascinating area that's explored. The book is The Last Call at the Hotel Imperial, The Reporters Who Took on a World at War. The author is Deborah Cohen. It's got a lot of great novelistic details and really reads quite nicely. I want to thank you so much for being with us today to talk about it on the 21st show.
It's been a complete pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that's all the time we have for our show today and this week. Before we go, I do want to urge you to visit our website, 21stshow.org, where you can find past shows. You can join our texting group, which you can also do by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. But on our website, you can also subscribe to our podcast. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, NPR One. You can find us there just by searching for The 21st. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey, Aiden Choate, and Erica Scalise, who's also our engagement producer. Our interns are Owen Henderson, Zainab Qureshi, and Brielle Scullark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again next week.